It's getting ready. There it is. Good morning, everyone. I wanted to provide you with notice, all meeting attendees with notice, that is. The meeting is recorded and Google is making a transcription of the meeting as well. The audio from the recording is posted to the A2A website. The Google transcription of the meeting is used for written meeting minutes. Linda, you're good to go.
I hereby call to order this regular meeting of the DES DDD District Central Independent Oversight Committee. Today's date is August 28th, 2023, and the time is 10:03 a.m. This is a regular meeting of the IOC. It is being held electronically. This meeting is being recorded, and the transcript of that recording will be posted on the ADOA IOC website. In an effort to avoid excess background noise and potential microphone feedback, please mute your microphone when you are not speaking. The host of the meeting can mute you, but then you can unmute yourself when you would like to speak. You can mute yourself by clicking on the microphone icon at the bottom left corner of your screen or elsewhere depending on the platform. Additionally, I have been asked to read the following statement. Do we have anyone that has to disclose a conflict of interest? If there is, the committee member needs to disclose why. Okay. And we now have an introduction of those present in this meeting. My name is Linda Meekham, and I am currently serving as the chair of District Central IOC. Debbie?
This is Debbie Stapley. I am currently serving as the vice chair, District Central IOC.
Eva?
Eva Hammett, a member of IOC.
Carolyn? You're on mute, my dear.
Sorry. Carolyn Wilmer, member of the IOC.
Thank you. Go ahead, Michelle. I'll let you introduce everybody else.
Okay. Leah?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Leah Gibbs, the administrator of the Office of Individual and Family Affairs for DDD.
James?
James Mayo, Quality Assurance Manager for District Central.
Patricia?
Patricia Sandino, PRC Chair at District Central.
Joan?
Joan McQuaid, DDD Office of Individual and Family Affairs.
Larry?
Good morning, Larry Allen with ADOA.
Dawn?
Good morning, everybody. Dawn McReynolds with United Healthcare OIFA.
Ian? Sorry, Ian, we can't hear you.
Sorry about that. Ian Wilson, everyone, United Healthcare Community Plans, Member Advocate and Veteran Liaison. Thanks.
And my name is Michelle Rademacher. I'm the DDD Independent Oversight Committee Liaison. Did I miss any staff?
Did you? Oh.
Okay. We also have Heidi.
Good morning. My name is Heidi Ernst. I am the incoming director at the Maricopa County Public Fiduciary's Office. And also in my office, who was having technical difficulty, this is Shawnee Patterson. She's our fiduciary manager here.
Thank you, Heidi. And Shawnee.
Thank you. And we also have Lenny.
Good morning.
Thank you, Lenny. Did we miss anyone else?
Who is Lenny?
This is Frederica Graham with Access.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Frederica.
Michelle, we'd like, who is Lenny? Who does he represent?
I believe Lenny's a guest. He's a guest from the public just sitting in listening to our meeting today.
Oh, okay. All right. Lenny, well,
yes.
I'm going to extend a call to the public and a welcome to you. You are invited to make a comment if you wish, but your comments will be limited to 3 minutes, and there will not be a discussion following your comments. So would you just like to tell us a little bit about yourself or what your interest is in our committee?
My name's Lenny, and my daughter is on DDD. She's a client, and I just want to learn more how I can help her and help the DDD.
Are you interested in becoming a member?
Possibly. It depends. Okay. I don't want another job. It depends on how many hours it is and what it entails and stuff. But it's a possibility.
Great. Well, we welcome you, and we hope that you will find us interesting enough and good enough advocates that you might find it in your daughter's best interest, as well as those served by DDD, to join us. We'd appreciate that. We'd enjoy having you on board, I believe. So thank you for attending.
Thank you.
Did someone else just call in on 49?
Yeah, this is Lisa Ellenberger. I was able to hop on for a little bit.
Oh, Lisa.
IOC member.
Oh, good. Where are you exactly?
I'm actually near Moab, Arizona, and so the reception's a little poor, but I'm here, and I'd like to at least attend as much as I can to listen. Oh,
good. I'm glad you're on board. So Lisa Lenny is a member of our committee also. She's traveling home, but just for your information. Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate everybody being here. I know it takes time out of your schedules to be here, but I just want you to know that I do appreciate it. So we'll turn a few minutes over to Heidi and her gang. The first order of business is a public fiduciary request for the individuals enrolled in DDD. And Heidi, the reason that I have requested this is because as I serve on PRC, we see that there's a need for some sort of oversight or help with the members in their money or in their decision making. And when we have asked, and I think Patricia can confirm this, if a public fiduciary has been requested, we have been told on numerous occasions that DDD has not approved this. And so I was a little bit confused as to why DDD would be involved in the process of going for a public or applying for a public fiduciary, and exactly what is the, and then I read somewhere as I was studying this out, trying to learn for myself, I read that the individual does apply to DDD first, and then DDD sends it on to public fiduciary. So I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. So that's why you're here. Okay.
Perfect. I think our presentation this morning will kind of help highlight some of those questions. I'm not entirely sure what the idea of DDD signing off, what that is, but I suspect it, once we talk it through, we'll be able to provide some clarity.
Perfect.
So with permission, I'm going to try and hit the share content button. We're going to try and take just one moment. See if that's. Can everyone now see my PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. I see that you guys have a packed agenda this morning, so I'm going to attempt to move through them fairly quickly. If anyone has questions, absolutely feel free to interject.
Heidi, you take whatever time you need, okay? We just. Okay. To make these times, okay?
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. All right. I do want to be respectful of everyone's time, but that takes a little pressure off, and to make sure we can address any questions that the committee members may have.
Sure.
So again, my name is Heidi Ernst. Right now, our director and public fiduciary is Josephine Jones. She will be retiring actually at the end of next week.
So my appointment will become effective on September the 9th. This is our overview to sort of what the public fiduciary can do, what our legal requirements are to proceed, and then hopefully we can open a little discussion on how DDD and the public fiduciary can try and meet our common goals of making sure that incapacitated adults are getting their demonstrated needs met to the best of our ability. I am trying to advance my slide, but it doesn't seem to be advancing. Okay, we're gonna go the old fashioned way. Is this all right? Can everyone see it if I share it this way? We're gonna go the old fashioned route. Just big picture, we're gonna give a brief introduction on the public fiduciary. We're gonna spend a lot of time kind of going through our community referral process, which I think might address some of the concerns already brought up. And then we're gonna go at a high level on what guardianship and conservatorships are and what the legal requirements are to appoint the public fiduciary in Arizona in those roles. And then we'll have a few touch points on emergencies, temporaries, or any of the cases that have an intersection with adult protective services, which is one of the considerations that we occasionally see with DDD referrals. The Maricopa County Public Fiduciary's Office provides professional and compassionate guardianship, conservatorship, and decedent services for incapacitated adults when no other person, agency, or corporation is willing or qualified to serve. As we get deeper into this presentation, I hope kind of that last clause and the complications that can bring to initiating a guardianship will become a little bit more clear. Our office has a great deal of support staff, but for these purposes, we can think of it, as having four main divisions. We have an investigations division that's going to look at cases and try and assess as much information as possible prior to any form of legal appointment. Then we have, of course, adult guardianships. The public fiduciary cannot serve as guardian for minors. We have conservatorships. We'll go over the difference between a guardianship and a conservatorship. And then what are known as decedent estate services for people who have passed away. I am going to try and launch this video. If anyone will just kind of let me know if we can hear it, then that'll be wonderful. It's about two minutes, and it gives a brief overview to what the responsibilities are for a guardian, but I am not sure everyone's going to be able to hear, so we're going to give it a shot. Where's the
county public fiduciary? Is a small department with a large impact on the lives of marginalized.
Is anyone able to hear that at all?
We can hear it. It's a little low. Very quiet. The volume is low.
Very low.
Corporation is qualified or willing to serve. The department is the fiduciary of last resort and is often appointed on difficult and complex cases. Public fiduciaries are directed by state statutes, rules established by the Arizona Supreme Court, and guided by the National Guardianship Association's standards of practice. Public fiduciaries carry caseloads controlled by appointment of the court. To ensure we are meeting our statutory and professional requirements, our department has several subdivisions that all work together to meet our ward's needs on a daily basis. Some of these subdivisions include fiduciary services, investigations, estate administration, and internal legal processing. The public fiduciary is appointed by the court to provide guardianship, conservatorship, and estate administration services for individuals who are not legally capable of making informed decisions. Additionally, our department offers an online community referral service for use by hospitals, adult protective services, mental health agencies, and the general public. Each ward is unique, and guardians are responsible for performing the many tasks necessary to ensure the statutorily required care and services are provided while encouraging maximum self-reliance and independence. Applying for and maintaining entitlements. Fiduciary guardians must ensure their wards receive any and all benefits for which they are entitled by applying for and providing documentation necessary to secure the benefit. Frequent reporting is necessary to maintain Social Security and all tax benefits. coordinating with care providers. Fiduciary guardians must ensure wards' demonstrated needs are being met through coordination of care across service providers, medical and mental health teams, community, family, and other supports. Coordinating care requires guardians to become involved with the ward's personal, medical, and financial needs. Guardians work in consultation and cooperation with other professionals to become knowledgeable on the issues facing the ward and provide informed consent on their behalf. Managing finances. In most cases, fiduciary responsibilities include receiving income for Social Security benefits or pensions and paying any expenses. Protecting assets. The public fiduciary is obligated to protect the ward's assets and must ensure resources are allocated properly. Some of these assets include bank accounts, real estate, personal belongings, storage units, and so much more. Conservatorship. The public fiduciary also acts as conservator. Conservatorships protect assets from waste, dissipation, or undue influence. These assets are larger or more complex than those administered by a guardianship alone. Fiduciaries must manage these assets to preserve them to the greatest extent possible, while still ensuring the needs of the ward are being met. Personal visits and welfare checks. The public fiduciary also conducts in-person visits and welfare checks with its ward. This might be in a private residence, group home, treatment facility, hospital, or other locations throughout the community. These required visits help fiduciaries ensure wards' needs are being met.
All right. Certainly when we made that that video, I didn't anticipate having to give this presentation. It's a little surreal, so thank you all for that. But that is just sort of the overview of the responsibilities of a guardian. Among those things that we're taking care of, right, coordinating care, ensuring that entitlements are in place, sometimes, especially for like a DDD client, oftentimes if a conservatorship is needed, it might arise out of an inheritance, something like that, where part of our fiduciary responsibility is not just the ongoing care, but also we take on the responsibility of pursuing whether or not there may be things like an inheritance or other funds or other entitlements owed back to that ward. So just wanted to go ahead and put that out there. So in terms of how does the public fiduciary become appointed? Because we must be appointed by a court before we may act. This spreadsheet, this little flowchart here, kind of gives you an overview to the major sources of just the initial petition filed in probate court in Maricopa County that might nominate the Maricopa County Public Fiduciary's Office to serve. Up here, we have what are known as guardian ad litems. I know it has the word guardian in it, which can make it very confusing. A guardian ad litem is also known as a best interest attorney. This is an attorney appointed on behalf of somebody going through a legal process in which that attorney may be authorized to act in what they believe is their client's best interest, even over the objection of their own ward, right, or of their own client. So this might arise out of mental health court. This might come from juvenile dependency court. This could come from criminal court, family court, civil court, any of these other scenarios in which a private citizen might intersect with the legal or the justice system such that a judicial officer says, I'm not convinced that this person can appreciate the consequences of their choices, and a guardian ad litem may be appointed. That guardian ad litem may then turn around and file a petition for guardianship nominating the public fiduciary to serve. Our office also does have that online community referral service that is this kind of entryway to a petition in which we receive an online referral. It's investigated through our team. And then if a petition is to be filed, our office is represented by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and a deputy county attorney at that level would review the investigation and then proceed with the petition process. It's also part possible for other third parties to nominate Any of these sources might result in an initial petition being filed in court. From the filing of that initial petition, there's a number of hearings that have to take place. There's a minimum initial hearing, but depending on complexity, it might require a trial, it might require ongoing status conferences, and this cycle can go through and sort of loop through depending on the details of the case. But only after we are actually appointed is the Public Fiduciary's Office authorized to take any direct action or provide any forms of consents on behalf of a client. We do have these two categories down here that are what we refer to as being off of the bench. These tend to be high need or high acuity. For instance, a ward already has a guardian and that guardian is in a serious critical car accident, right? And so the court just needs to put a temporary guardian in place until the primary guardian, let's say, recovers from the hospital or those kinds of things. In those sorts of emergency situations, occasionally the probate bench will appoint the public fiduciary without any notice to our office because of a situation like that, where someone who's already been identified by the court as an incapacitated person has a sudden and immediate need for a substitute guardian. We would call that a successor guardian, but I think in layman's terms, it's more like a substitute, someone filling in until that guardian is able to take over their responsibilities again. Any kind of questions on this general process of what the legal cycle looks like? We're gonna go through some of the specifics about our office bringing that petition, but that guardianship is a legal process and that it's not really up to the public fiduciary whether or not an appointment is made, right? All of this gets decided before a judicial officer, and it's only by order of the court that the public fiduciary is appointed and can act. Yeah. I especially with the DDD population, I think the clients that we share in common, a lot of these do arise through our community referral process, so I wanted to put in just a brief overview. First, that online referral is submitted. It is just on our website, which is www.maricopa.gov/pubfid, like public fiduciary, and it's available right there on our website. Once submissions are put through, they are reviewed for completeness, right, to make sure a bot didn't fill it in or something like that. A health professional report is required, and I list this specifically that it has to be a physician, psychologist, or registered nurse completing that HPR. I will be the first to acknowledge that just like many other community agencies, that specific requirement can be difficult, right? Physician's assistants in a lot of clinical situations are the prescriber for an office, or there may be all kinds of other healthcare professionals providing absolute quality care to our mutual clients. Unfortunately, by statute, only a physician, psychologist, or registered nurse may complete those health professionals report to comply with state statute. So that is not one of our requirements. That one is set in the law. Once we have all of that information and we know it was a complete referral that included the health professionals report, it'll be assigned out to an investigator. That investigator's first task is going to be contacting the referring party with initial questions and clarifying information. They're going to do an in-person interview and assessment of the proposed ward being referred upon. We're going to gather records. Those might be educational records, medical records, financial records, APS records, court records, all kinds of things, just depending on the specific needs of the ward. Financial information, including what entitlements they are currently on and what entitlements they may be that they may be eligible for but not receiving, particularly within the DDD community. For the public fiduciary, often one of the difficulties that we encounter is not being able to access education records or medical records from before they turned 18 years old. That can be very, very difficult for us. It seems like even with our appointment that we ought to have access to those things, but that is not part and parcel. So if we were a biological parent, right, and you have a DDD child who then becomes an adult, becoming their guardian may just be a continuation, right? And that parent already has background knowledge and educational knowledge and access to medical records. The public fiduciary is a government agency, even appointed for a DDD client on their 18th birthday. We may struggle to get those same educational records, medical records, et cetera, to initiate an application for DDD services if we have reason to believe that they would otherwise be eligible. One other thing that is required of our investigations is to look through what are known as parties with priority. We'll go into that a little bit more fully, but in short, the public fiduciary is regarded by statute as the guardian of last resort. And we are number 11 of 11 on a statutory list of people that the law presume ought to serve as a guardian or conservator before considering the public fiduciary as an appropriate appointment. After running through that investigator will make a recommendation on whether or not the case can support the legal requirements for the establishment of an adult guardianship or conservatorship through clear and convincing evidence, as those are the standards set by statute. And that recommendation is then advanced to our deputy county attorneys. And if we are recommending a petition, it then essentially moves into process to begin being drafted, filed, calendared out, etc. So among the requirements for recommending that a case be petitioned upon, one is that the health professional who authored that health professional's report is technically going to be appointed by the probate court. It's one of the perfunctory requirements that in the petition requesting the guardian request the appointment of that doctor or that health professional who authored it. Generally speaking, that report is going to be sufficient, but in the event that there is any kind of objection, if there is a family member or other support who's interested in serving, or any kind of concern regarding that case, that health professional will be necessary to be subpoenaed and may need to testify to back up the opinions that they're providing in that health report. So sometimes that can be difficult, especially if the health professional completing it, let's say, was at a hospital. And by the time the court case comes up, this person's already left the hospital. And so that doctor may no longer be willing to testify. There is a legal requirement, and it's constitutional due process, to provide certain parties with notice of the guardianship action. This can be of concern when biological parents, other supports may be legally entitled to notice, but they've been estranged. There might be some checkered history there. Any of those concerns, which we absolutely understand, do not relieve the legal requirement to notify them of the guardianship proceeding. The probate court will appoint an attorney for the proposed ward, and that attorney must have the opportunity to meet with their client. Also required by statute is that a probate court investigator be appointed. So even though the public fiduciary may have already assigned an investigator and conducted its own investigation, that is not statutorily sufficient for the appointment of a guardian. The probate court must appoint and assign its own investigator to come out and interview the proposed ward and the other pertinent parties regarding the petition. It is not uncommon for a new petition request to not get before the court for up to 60 days out from the date of filing. Again, if there are any objections or concerns, it may go to evidentiary hearing, which is the probate version of a trial, to bring further evidence. And that's where most likely the health professional would need to be willing and available for testimony. In those events where the health professional is no longer available or willing to testify, it triggers a new notice, a new hearing requirement. In a lot of ways, it starts to reset that clock because a lot of these requirements about notice are considered constitutional. They are due process rights, and so they cannot be moved around, or we don't have the option of requesting that it be waived or things like that. So it's just not that kind of a requirement. This is just big picture, just to kind of provide an overview of from our community referrals and the petitions that result in our own appointment. As you can see, over half, just about half of them do arise out of hospitals or difficult discharge cases. And DDD represents approximately 3% at this time, back in from the 2020 to 21. We don't have updated numbers on this, so this is the most up-to-date numbers I can provide. Are there any kind of questions on those big picture considerations before we kind of get into the specifics in Arizona of what's required to be proved before a guardian can be put in place? Oh, I see a hand. Linda. I'm just delighted that that worked.
I'm paying attention here. I've got it. So when you were talking about who could recommend, is that the right word? Who could refer someone to be okay? Yeah. And could like we IOC refer that, or a provider agency make that referral if we see in the course of our doing our duties, if we see that that is needed?
Certainly, any member of the public, a member of your committee, a member of your agency, absolutely is welcome to submit one of those online referrals. The only piece I would remind you is that whomever submits that referral will be considered the point of contact for that referral through the duration of that investigation.
Okay. So
whomever submits it should be prepared and sort of anticipating contact back from an investigator, and that they might be the ongoing point of contact, especially if someone is, if the proposed ward is in a state of flux, right? They've lost a placement, they're experiencing a health crisis, any of those kinds of things. Whomever that referring party is likely to receive a lot of ongoing contact throughout the duration of that investigation. And so I would just, because for instance, a real common one is that perhaps like a doctor wants to do it, but they might have a nurse or someone submit that thing, but the person who actually submits it is going to become the point of contact.
So the nurse, not the doctor's office, right?
Correct. So, you know, so just whomever actually submits it and provides their contact information, that person should anticipate some ongoing, I don't want to call it a responsibility, but ongoing contact, and they will be considered that referral source. We don't allow anonymous referrals, and we do not allow referrals on behalf of a third party. So I can't go in and say, Linda asked me to submit this, but call Linda for info. That we don't allow. Right.
So if an agency thinks that it's necessary, a provider agency, they could contact you, but it still has to be that particular person, not the agency itself, correct?
Correct.
Got to be a person. Okay. And then the second question, when you were talking about parties with priority, mm-hmm. what, for example, there is family around.
Right.
But the family has refused to do it. Mm-hmm. Because that was actually one of the reasons given for not having a public fiduciary. The one side was saying there's family involved, and so we're not going to grant PubFid. And then the other side was saying the family didn't want to be involved. So how does that work?
That is a great question. We're going to touch on prior in just a couple of slides. So if I can, I think the answer I will give you will make more sense in context. So if you can give me three slides to get there, I think that's your question.
That's fine. Okay. I think Eva has a question too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Okay. So who pays for these lawyers?
So
I know when you do guardianship, you know, if the individual that needs to be protected from whoever is seeking guardianship, if they have assets, they have to pay for court-appointed lawyer. And so who pays for the lawyer in this situation?
Correct. So in the event that a petition is filed, the court-appointed attorney, any investigation fees, if there is both a GAL and a court-appointed attorney, all of those fees are imputed to the ward, to their estate. If they are found to be indigent in the court's eyes, then the Office of Court Counsel will pay those attorneys. If for any reason the proposed ward does have assets sufficient, their estate will pay for those attorneys. And incidentally, upon appointment of the public fiduciary, we also assess fees, right? We also charge fees. We're professional licensed fiduciaries. So even the service after appointed, once appointed, the public fiduciary does invoice its clients. We are also not a free service.
What is that fee?
It is dependent upon, it is assessed on the 10th of an hour. And our fee schedule is disclosed upon our involvement in the petition, but it depends on what level of staff and complexity of task was being completed. So a guardian doing the daily business, like let's say visiting their ward, will be charged at a given rate, but the work of the benefits specialist to reach out to Social Security will be at a lower rate. So it slides depending on the nature of the activity, but all of that is disclosed as required by statute in the court through what's known as a disclosure of fiduciary compensation. The guardian ad litem will file one, the court appointed attorney will file one, and the professional nominated guardian, whether a private fiduciary or the public fiduciary, will also file one.
So it's a sliding scale, you said?
It is not a sliding scale, but it depends on the level of the staff who are doing the task. So a guardian might be $85 an hour, but a benefit specialist might be $55 an hour.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Certainly. All right. So one of the things that I'll point out real quick here is and I'm going to give you the 10,000 foot view on the difference between a guardianship and conservatorship. One of the things I just want to throw out here right at the beginning is that this is very specific to Arizona. Know that different states use the words guardian and conservator differently or interchangeably. So for instance, if anyone has followed the Britney Spears ongoing case, in California, it's all a conservator. You're the conservator of the person or you're the conservator of their estate. In Arizona, you can be the guardian of the person, but the conservator of their estate. It places in the Midwest, it's the other way around. You can be the guardian of the person or the guardian of their estate. So these terms are specific to how they're being used here in Arizona, just in case you follow any kind of stories in this practice area outside of the state of Arizona and the words seem like they're mixing together. That is not a misunderstanding. It is very much controlled by what state you're in. So in Arizona, the person protected under a guardianship is referred to as a ward, and the adult guardianship is a protective arrangement that is actually the removal of certain civil rights and the delegation of those rights to a third party. The responsibilities of a guardian, in as much as possible, is to maintain as much independence and autonomy as is possible for that ward, to try and allow them as much input as possible into the decisions that the guardian makes. And the role of the guardian is to listen to that ward and to ensure their preferences are being met as long as it does not create a substantial harm. Under the National Guardianship Association's rules of practice that are the best practice guidelines for professional guardians, one of the things that we'll hear a lot about is this idea of using substituted judgment versus best interest. Substituted judgment is preferred by the law in Arizona, as well as by the National Guardianship Association. The idea being to, in as much as possible, for the guardian to substitute their own judgment for the choice that the underlying ward would have made if they were still legally able to make their own decisions. So this is very much about utilizing their input and maximizing their independence and autonomy and honoring the individual rights and preferences of the person. Best interest is going to be used where the preferences might create a serious harm or injury, or if it's unable to be known what the ward would have wanted for themselves. Guardians are also authorized to handle small amounts of money so long as there is no conservator appointed. So in most cases that come through the public fiduciary's office, that's going to essentially be administering their Social Security benefits. They may have, you know, VA benefits through a relative or something like that. But any of those financial matters, we as the guardian can handle and address. It is very much about coordinating services and pursuing any and all entitlements to which the ward may be eligible. The pursuit of benefits is not elective. That one is a requirement. We do every once in a while have a ward who, you know, doesn't want to be on welfare or something like this. That might be the kind of thing that they say. But the law requires that we pursue any and all benefits to which they may be entitled. Guardians, though, are not primary care providers. What we do is coordinate services and provide consent for those services. But for instance, the public fiduciary is not able to transport its wards to appointments. Candidly, we're not able to attend most medical appointments. So our ability to see a ward like on a day-to-day basis, or some of the time, especially if a ward has had a family member guardian for years and that family member is no longer able to serve, we very much wanted to make sure we're setting those expectations that a family guardian might be able to, you know, take their ward to every doctor's appointment, and the public fiduciary's office is not going to be able to provide those kinds of services. And in fact, we cannot put our wards even into our county cars. So all of those pieces have to, just in terms of setting expectations of what a guardian can do. And of course, this idea of informed consent. I say this all the time. I ask more questions about a flu shot for a ward than I might even consider asking my own doctor recommending that I start taking a prescription medication. This notion of informed consent, asking what are the pros, what are the cons, what's the cost if we do nothing right now? What is the outcome if we were to wait on this decision? These are all specific questions and lines of inquiry that are recommended by the National Guardianship Association to ensure that a professional guardian is making as informed and full knowledge consents on behalf of wards as is possible, right? So any of these things here, what's necessitating the decision? What are alternatives to this decision? What happens if we make this decision later versus sooner versus no action at all? Should we seek a second opinion? Should we seek out the opinion of family and friends? All of those things will go into an informed consent decision on behalf of a guardian. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but just so you know, in Arizona, there are these five, we're going to call them prongs, that must be proven through clear and convincing evidence before the court may appoint a guardian. I don't want to get too deep into this, but I do want to note right here, incapacity is prong two of five before the appointment of a guardian can be made. And I think this one, especially from a healthcare provider's perspective, can feel like all that's necessary. This person is incapacitated. Why can't they have a guardian? Because that is only one of five considerations that must be proven through clear and convincing evidence before a judicial officer may lawfully appoint an adult guardian. Jurisdiction and venue, don't worry about too much. For our purposes here, our main concern is that the person is residing in Maricopa County and otherwise connected enough to the state of Arizona that the Maricopa County Superior Court is the appropriate place to hear this guardianship case. So for instance, if I live in Los Angeles and I'm on my way to a road trip to Las Vegas and I get into a serious car accident here in Phoenix, Phoenix may or may not be the appropriate place to set up my guardianship. Does that kind of make sense just on an anecdotal level? I don't want to get too deep into that one. That one can get very complicated and generally is not going to arise in a case that we may share together. Again, incapacity, the highlights that I want to point out here is that incapacity is not a health provider's opinion. Incapacity is a legal finding under Title 14. That is a legal finding or an order that a judicial officer would enter into the record. They will enter that finding of incapacity into the record based on medical evidence provided by a doctor. But this is why sometimes, like, the requirement on that health professional's report, who completes it, or there need to be available for testimony if required, why that can become so critical for the success of a petition before the court, but also that it's, again, just not sufficient for a doctor to say this person is incapacitated, as if that kind of closes the book on whether or not a guardian ought to be put in place. This is running through all of the requirements in that health professional's report. It's available on our website. It's available on the court's website. I don't want to get too deep into that, other than to say all of the requirements and all of the questions on that form arise out of the statutory requirements for the finding of incapacity, and that's why we utilize the court's form. Once someone is found to be in the right place, right, we're in the right county, we're in the right state, and they are deemed to be incapacitated, then the statutes require that it be proved through clear and convincing evidence that the guardianship is necessary to provide for the demonstrated needs. So if a proposed ward is able to secure the right kind of housing, income, entitlements, medication, or services, then it is right, then the guardianship is not necessary to provide those demonstrated needs. Those needs are already being met through what are known as less restrictive alternatives, that those same needs cannot be met through less restrictive means. Among those options are things like the existence of a power of attorney, testamentary documents, let's say from the parent of a DDD adult who may have nominated somebody to serve on behalf of the DDD client, surrogate medical decision making under 36, 32, 31, any of the formal supports that may help, so court orders for treatment, a representative payee or VA custodian to administer income benefits. There might be an outpatient team. There may be probation or parole officers, and then also all of the informal supports that can help move a client through their needs. So family, friends, neighbors, and then this notion of supportive decision making. I will point out that SB 1291 has just recently passed in the past couple of months. I believe it goes effective towards the end of October, and a large push in the changes proposed under SB 1291 were to include these and to bolster the supportive decision making platform and increase access to and participation from family and friends in ongoing guardianship and conservatorships. So one of the things that we are seeing, at least right now before the legislature, is a swing and a trend towards these less restrictive alternatives, including the use of supportive decision making. Only after all of those prongs have been hit, right? Jurisdiction, venue, capacity, and the demonstrated needs cannot be met through less restrictive means, only when all of those things are found through clear and convincing evidence may a judicial officer then appoint a guardian for an adult. Only then will they then say, okay, now we've just established that a guardian ought to be put in place. The last question, prong number five, who ought to serve? Who are these parties with priority? These are parties in the following order, so meaning bullet one is the most preferred and public fiduciary at the bottom is as the last resort, who ought to be considered for appointment in this guardianship. So a guardian or conservator that's already appointed in another state, right? The family has just moved from Ohio, now they live here, we're going to continue forward, the law assumes that guardian should continue to serve. A person nominated by the incapacitated person, if they are able to make such an opinion. A person nominated to serve in a power of attorney, spouse, adult children, parents of the alleged incapacitated person. A person nominated in the last will of one of the parents to serve. any relative residing with them for at least 6 months, the nominee of a person who's caring for or paying the benefits of that person, the VA, and then finally down to the public fiduciary. In order to skip over a party with priority, the court must be able to provide good cause, right? A justifiable reason to skip over that person with priority. That is kind of the big picture on the appointment of adult guardianships. Yep, Linda, what have you got?
So refusal by any of the above, does that count?
Refusal to serve as a nominee, yes. But if they're willing to provide surrogate medical decision-making or otherwise be part of that supportive decision network for a party, that is not the same as saying that they don't want to be appointed in court as the person's guardian.
Right. So the fact that the reason for denial is because there is family, even though the family has refused, that doesn't fit in this scenario, correct?
Generally speaking, so I don't want to quibble with your interpretation of that recommendation.
I don't even remember who it is. That's just a citation.
Certainly. No, absolutely. So one of the things though that we do find is that you may have a family member who is not willing to, or for any other reason, you know, they don't want to be appointed in the court process, but they are willing to act as a surrogate decision maker or to otherwise facilitate discharge benefits,
right,
those kinds of things. And I think sometimes the disconnect comes between like, well, if they're not willing to be guardian, then they're not appropriate. But Title 14 and the guardianship statutes really rely on this idea of, well, if they're willing to participate in a less restrictive arrangement than a formal appointment of a guardian, and that can still meet the demonstrated needs, then the law prefers that situation to the formality, cost, and expense of the appointment of a guardian.
Okay, let's just say that they don't want anything to do with this individual.
Uh-huh.
Then it goes to PubFed, correct or no?
So there are no bright lines on this, just like none of us would want like a bright line, right? We're just a government agency, right?
Right.
A bright line rule on how to address your individual needs and wants. Everything is going to be on a case-by-case basis for what is, you know, in the best interest for that proposed ward. In the event, so if the ward has sufficient assets, a private fiduciary might be an appropriate appointment before the public fiduciary. Or just because one of the adult parents is not willing to be involved, that doesn't mean that a cousin or someone else within the support network for that person may not be an appropriate appointment, you know, in advance for priority over the public fiduciary. So it would just depend on the specifics for that proposed ward.
I understand that. All I'm asking is if there is no one else,
mm-hmm,
then we can do what the front your office is, then that could happen if your avenues have been exhausted.
Certainly. And that's where, you know, absolutely make the referral, just, you know, that the referral is only that, right? It's not a guarantee.
Right. I understand.
The petition will be advanced or that we would even be appointed, but just to recognize from the public fiduciary standpoint, or really anyone in this practice area, what the requirements are under Title 14 before that petition even gets brought before the court. And the high level of evidentiary, the high evidentiary standard of clear and convincing evidence that needs to be met.
And where can we find Title 14?
I'm so sorry, where can you find Title 14?
Yes.
If you went and Googled Arizona Revised Statutes,
ARS Title 14.
Title 14, and that is where all, so deceased estate, minor guardians, and adult guardians, and conservatorships, all of those will be listed there under Title 14. If you go to the 5300s, that's going to hit you at the guardians, which will be, my guess is 90% of our client overlap.
I don't mean to beat a dead horse, I'm sorry, but in case this comes up again, I just want to have in my wheelhouse what what the law is with regards to this and make suggestions as to whether these other avenues have been exhausted. Because clearly it is a rights violation if the member is not being properly protected. And so, you know, that's our role on the program review committee. And so I just want to make sure that we have the information that we need in order to make appropriate suggestions. So that's why I'm asking these questions.
No, absolutely. And if, you know, we have no expectation that any other agency needs to become sort of the expert on this. So if you have a case and you're not sure, make the referral. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I don't want you to keep calling me. No. I'm sorry, go ahead.
All right, so I'm going to go very, very quickly through conservatorship, not because I think it's a hot pressing issue. I just want to call out the differences here between the adult guardianship and the adult conservatorship, just so that at a high level, it makes sense why in one case we might pursue one course versus another. In Arizona, the person under the conservatorship is referred to as a protected person rather than the ward. And while the guardianship is very much about protecting that, right, in the guardianship, it's about their health, their well-being, their medical care, their behavioral health care, where they live, where their income comes from. A conservatorship is about assets, right? As the conservator, the first priority is to marshal and protect the assets of the estate. You have an obligation to discuss the decisions about what you're going to do with those assets with the protected person. Substituted judgment rules still apply, just like in the guardianship, but the focal point is about their assets and the things that they have, quote unquote, as opposed to the individual themselves. Meaning marshaling those assets might include collecting, closing out bank accounts, might involve selling a home. It might involve collecting an inheritance, any of those kinds of things. Setting an appropriate budget to try to conserve those assets to the maximum amount possible for the use and ongoing care of the protected person. To restrict appropriate assets when necessary. So if there is a home, but the protected person is able to continue to live in it, then that home may simply be restricted such that it could not be sold without court approval. And then, of course, to provide ongoing accountings to the court to demonstrate how the funds are being used and protected. The very big picture here, though, is if you look, remember, guardianship had five prongs, right? Conservatorship does not have five prongs. It only has four. Do you see how there's no incapacity requirement for conservatorship? Again, conservatorship is about protecting the assets and not the underlying person. So again, are the assets located in Maricopa County and or Arizona such that it makes sense for our courts to even be involved? Estate contents and value, meaning what is it that they have? What are the value of the things that they have? And what are their liabilities? And what is the value of that so that you can determine it? I think for our shared client base, the most common one may be some form of legal settlement or some form of an inheritance, I think are the two largest scenarios where the Public Fiduciary's Office and this oversight committee might find cases in common for discussion and investigation. And again, that the conservatorship is necessary to protect those assets from waste, dissipation, or undue influence, that there's not a less restrictive, less expensive, less court-involved means to protect those same assets. And then, of course, priority, which runs in the exact same order as it does for guardianship. Just big picture, any kind of questions on the difference between guardianship and conservatorship? Okay. And then just very, very briefly, just to, you know, to point out, there is the option for what are known as emergency temporary appointments. The thing with emergency temporary appointments is it must be proved that there's an immediate and irreparable harm that may come if the matter is not heard before a judicial officer within, let's say, 3 to 5 days, such that the normal notice requirements can happen after the fact or with not as much, like you don't have a 2-week window for notice that it can come up right away. However, for the bar for this can be very high. As an example, during the pandemic, we often had, you know, cases that desperately needed to be discharged from hospital, but there were also difficulties in getting people placed into group homes and doing screenings and getting COVID tests and all of that before they could be discharged. And this office was not successful in bringing forward that that was an emergency scenario to remove somebody from a hospital under those circumstances. So just to be clear, so there is that emergency option, but it very much can depend on which judicial officer you are in front of. I can think of a particular case where we had two fraternal sisters, both DDD clients, that we tried to advance as emergency temporary petitions. And in that instance, for whatever reason, they ended up getting split. So our two petitions for the two sisters were seen in front of two different judicial officers. We were appointed on one and not on the other. They were in the same group home. They had the same diagnoses. They had the same everything. One judicial officer felt that was an emergency and appointed us on a temporary basis, and the other did not. So just to say that even when we think we have a solid case, it does not always work out the way that we anticipate it will. And then just specifically for our shared clientele base, it can be difficult when, you know, we're reaching out to family and friends or other interested parties who are entitled by the law to have notice of what we're doing. And even though they may not have been involved or there might be a checkered history there, we still have to alert them to what we're doing. Again, our difficulty in obtaining records, especially before they turned 18, to help initiate applications for DDD benefits. And then, for instance, finding that maybe a prior guardian or family member, let's say, was the payee for Social Security and they have passed, but now we're having to wait, you know, however many months for Social Security to recognize that and recognize the public fiduciary as the new payee and reroute that. So we may end up with a ward who goes through a period of sometimes 6 and 8 months just waiting for their Social Security to start to be rerouted to us. We do not get priority at Social Security. We don't have priority at getting folks onto Altex. We don't have priority getting folks into placements or group homes or any of those kinds of things. And we also do not have any ability to advance funds on behalf of our ward. So if we have a ward and their Social Security is not coming, we have no ability to pay those costs up front and kind of pay it back when Social Security begins. We can only provide for them the entitlements and income that they themselves are entitled to, and only as quickly as we can obtain them following the same processes as any other lay guardian would. So that is sort of a big picture on what we had today. Any questions, comments, or anything else we can do for you during this meeting?
Carolyn,
thank you.
You're on mute, Carolyn.
Sorry, gosh. Okay, so for the requirement of getting a physician, a psychologist, or an RN to make that report, whose responsibility is it to make that happen?
So that would come from the referring party at the time of submitting a referral through our online submission portal. So that the PDF, the health professional's report, is available on the website, and that referring party would need to have that completed and signed to submit along with their referral, what do you call that, a fillable PDF that's online.
So that makes it really hard for example, that would make it really hard for IOC to make a referral, I would think, a member of IOC.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
That's why we need to encourage probably an agency and be a reference for them.
Yeah.
How to, based upon the information that Heidi's given us for how to proceed.
Yeah.
Patricia?
Well, my question wasn't related to that. It was related to
once it's denied, can the team appeal? And how many times can they appeal?
So the public fiduciary does not have an appeals process for its community referrals, but every time we close out a referral, we always offer that if there is a significant change in circumstance for the proposed ward, that absolutely you're welcome to re-refer that person, but it does require a change in circumstance. We don't have a formal appeal process.
Heidi, just so you know, Patricia is our program review committee chair, so she sees a lot of these as well.
Oh, great.
FYI, yeah. Anyone else have questions for Heidi? Well, I, for one, want to thank you so very much for coming. You've answered a lot of my questions and as well as a few others. And I appreciate the time that you took to prepare and to attend. It's. Oh, wait, I'm not even on camera. You can't see how sincere I am.
No problem. And if you would like, let me stop sharing the screen. I'll stop monopolizing everyone's screen space here. But if you would like, I do need to jump on to my next meeting, but what I'll do is I can zip up this PowerPoint, and Great. If it's all right, I think Michelle, I got my original invitation from you, so if it's all right, I'll just send it straight to Michelle and she can distribute it to the members of the
committee. Perfect. That's wonderful. Carolyn, did you have one more question for Heidi?
That was my question.
Yeah. All right. And if there's any questions or anything to our contact information, it will be on that last slide. Feel free to reach out to us.
Appreciate it, Heidi. You have a great day, all right?
Thank you, committee members. Thank you.
Bye. Let's see. So that was great. I thought it was great. Eva, if you don't mind, I'm going to skip yours real quick and just to, because I want to give you full time, but I also want to get in a few things that I need to say, okay, before. First of all, with regards to the, so we're skipping down to the updates from the statewide and follow up from that. There was a discussion on the PRN meds that were funded in residential setting, and they are PRN meds. And James, you can step in and clarify this, but I hope I've captured the gist of it. There was an issue that we had in PRC where PRN meds were being administered. I had an issue with that, issue and concern. So follow-up and elevated med review indicated that PRN meds are allowed in an ADH setting if and when the staff is not involved in any way with the administration, storage, and monitoring of the PRN med. Additionally, the reason for taking the medications prescribed needs to be consistent in both the PCSP and the BTP per the doctor's order, and there is thorough documentation regarding the medication. Did I get that, James?
Yep, sounds right.
Yay. All right. Patricia, you understand that the same way, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you repeat that, Linda? That was just a lot of information.
How about if I email it to you?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, all right, because it is important because we see that from time to time. Okay, and if you have questions, give me a call. All right, and then with regards to the PCSP inconsistencies update for while we're sitting in PRC, the things that are being, you didn't have a hand when you joined. Okay, so Barb Crawford, Leah, Cindy Treadwell and I, we held a meeting subsequent to the statewide, and upon close review of the BTP and the PCSP, it was noted that there are generally the following areas in the PCSP that are left blank or not completed. So while you're doing PRC, be sure to check that the section one, where they have the personally person responsible information, that that's completed. And section Roman numeral two, the member profile, the brief background, and alignment to the BTP if applicable and updated on the PCSP. Let's see. And then there a concern is regarding the BTP, individuals that do not have a BTP, that this section is not being completed, but we have no way of checking it or finding out. So that's an encouragement to the support coordinators to make sure that that is completed. And current meeting notes, where do those go? Do those go in section number two? That's a question that needs to be answered. Under section Roman numeral five, the HAB goals and strategies need to be documented. Generally, that is left blank, and a supervisor from DDD explained to me that the first part, what needs to be done, references behaviors or steps that need to be taken for the member to be successful in completing his goals. And the second part, who will do that, is who will complete that or who will take care of those barriers being removed. Section 10, if there are rights restrictions, this is where they go specifically. And it needs to be documented in this section along with the rationale and PRC/IOC approval. And they can check with the BTP in particular, because that will show that information. The medications, of course, need to align in both the BTP and the PCSP. The spending plan needs to be completed and included. Signatures and dates on the PCSP. And I was reviewing, because there is a signature on the signature page for the BTP, but it specifically says that this is team agreement for the BTP. It does not say for the BTP and the PCSP. So just make sure that we have team agreement for both. They are separate documents. Is that correct, Leah? Am I correct? Yes, okay. And with regards to support coordinators being required to attend PRC, as they are the keeper of the records, Barb indicated that during COVID, attendance was not mandatory, but beginning in the fall, I think that she said by November, that all support coordinators will be required to attend. And I would just like to give a shout out to our district program manager, Megan Doherty, for making it mandatory for the support coordinators in District Central to attend. They've been great. And I think Patricia would agree with that, and they're there. So, and then with regards to the incident reports and the access portal, which is coming down the pipe pretty quick, I understand. We have been informed that by Michelle that she believes the liaisons will train the IOC members on and assist with access to the portal and looking at the incident reports. And to that point, do we need to have someone come to our meeting to give us the training, or would this be done on a one-to-one or one-to-two basis, depending on the schedules via Google Meets? So I guess Michelle could answer that, or we can just consider that in the future. With regards to ECT, I just think that it's real important. Leah's got a smile on her face. Okay, I want to hear this, right? Okay, I just think it's real important that, Zane mentioned that in the statute as it now stands, it's discriminatory. And I think you said that also, Leah, when you were presenting it to us, against the DD individuals, as it specifically prohibits them from receiving ECT. And we discussed this, our IOC did, at length. And if you remember Carol McNulty, she stated that she had a, she's been on the committee since its inception and also has a memory like an elephant. She's recalled several times, as have I, over the years when the then HRC approved this procedure for DDD members. So, you know, I don't know if that's a point of consideration, but what I do think is that when we're looking at ECT being approved, I think that we need to make sure that there's a continual reference to the fact that IOC needs to approve it. And just IOC approval. And I would like to see a little more data on what has been done as far as the results and the pros and cons, that sort of thing. So I just think that those are things we need to consider when we're looking at this ECT or when DDD is looking at ECT. Do you have anything, Leah, with regards to that? No? Okay.
I don't, Linda, other than you received correspondence right through Michelle about a meeting that Zane wants to have with the IOCs. Am I right, Michelle?
Oh, on September 7th?
No.
No?
That's a different meeting.
I can't keep them straight.
I think it's the 12th. Am I right, Michelle?
Yes. September 12th is what we were looking at for a meeting with Zane. That was sent to the chairs.
The September 7th date, Linda.
September 11th or 12th. That was the one. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And so it is set for the 12th, Michelle?
Yes.
Do we have a time or we don't know yet? You'll send out the invite?
I'm assuming I'll be sending it out. I want to check with Zane or and Leah to confirm that. But we're looking at tentatively at 5:30 on September 12th.
Is that what you've heard, Leah, 5:30? Okay. And in District West IOC, they would like to have anyone from their IOC who wants to attend invited to this meeting. So if you want to send it out to our committee, that would be great. If anyone wants to attend, that way we won't have to take up time in this meeting where I have to report back. So you guys will get it all firsthand. Thank you both. All right. And then the parents as paid providers, this is the last item. It just that they are that DDD is looking to, or Access is looking, sorry, to make this permanent, where the parents of children under 18 continue on as paid providers. And I believe it's just attendant care, not HAB. Is that correct, Leah?
In the document that Access shared publicly, prior to their public forum, it was attendant care, not HAB. The public forum feedback period closed on the 21st of August, and we do not know what their final proposal to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is going to look like yet.
Okay. All right. So, but they're looking to make it. So that's the update on the parent as a paid provider. And that's all I have. Leah, it's your turn. I mean, Eva, sorry, Leah, Eva, you both have a lot to say, I know, but sorry. So can I just do an introduction, Eva? I just want to give kudos to you, Eva, because Eva is the reader of everything that comes out from DDD. And I need to have a separate email address just for Eva because she sends me so much stuff. But she is excellent at wading through all this stuff, coming up with the points. And she and I have emailed back and forth. We've talked on the phone and we've tried to make it concise. She informed me this morning that she found some more stuff. So I'm a little scared what she has to say. But anyway, you're great, Eva. We appreciate everything that you do, especially reading. It's a lot. So go ahead.
Thank you. So my big issue is, Ben, I'm going to use the term SARS, and what that SARS is, seclusion and restraint. And what happened is they came out with a new policy, 962, on SARS. And I had asked Linda, because in the SARS report, they talk about three different rules. And she found them for me. Thank you very much, because I can't find these things. And one of them is Arizona Code 921-204. And part of what I'm going to talk about is because periodically, not every month, but periodically, we get our SARS report on our DD members who are in ASH. And this month, we got the July reports for 20 days. And one individual gets put into mechanical restraints almost every 48 hours. And in 20 days, he's had 7 mechanical restraints. And this is going to be important. And I could not find, unfortunately, I went back and looked at, I thought I was looking at the July IOC stuff, but in, so if I missed that one, but the last time I found one was a SARS report from May, and it listed 3 individuals who were in mechanical restraints. One of them was in mechanical restraints for 160 minutes. One of them was in seclusion, which I had never seen before, for almost 2 hours. And then the other one, who is the only one in our July one, he was in 12 mechanical restraints. 2 of them were over 3 hours long. Now, these are my questions that I was originally going to ask for reports, but on the same token, reading, because in 962 in the supplemental information, it says that Access Office of Human Rights and IOCs, where the SARS occurred, may take action, whatever action is appropriate in accordance with the applicable rule of our 9-21-204. And in, so these are when I, I did not give you the whole report, but based upon that report, this is the kind of information that we're not getting in the IOCs that, excuse me, let me close the door. So this is the kind of information we're not getting in IOCs, and maybe these are the kind of information that quality management needs to find out. First of all, what was the other least restrictive method tried that was unsuccessful? Number two is, was there an ordinary physician for the restraint? And if not, was he on call during the duration? So in other words, they cannot have a standing order for SARS. And on the same token, they cannot have SARS within 24 hours of each other. So I found it very interesting that when I looked at these mechanical restraints, they were almost 48 hours apart. Then if you are in a mechanical restraint, here, number 4, what was the criteria for release from the mechanical restraints? Do we ever hear that? Well, okay, so the mechanical restraints are supposed to be loosened every 15 minutes. And then they have to have an opportunity to eat, and they have to have an opportunity to, they have to be asked if they need to toilet after 2 hours. And number seven, which I find very interesting, which is the fact that after multiple stars, they are supposed to have the medical director shall require a special meeting of the client's clinical team, according to R9-21-314, to determine whether other treatment interventions would be useful and whether modification of the ISP or the ITDP are required. Now, is this happened? So these are what, then number eight, we had to ask for these SARS reports. And then in the law, it says on the 10th month, the program director shall prepare and file with the office and IOC a written report describing the use of any form of seclusions during the preceding month in the mental health or by the employees. In the case of in-person facilities, ASH, the report shall be filed with any patient or human rights committee for that facility. We have not been getting these, except, you know, maybe quarterly, maybe every 2 months, whatever. Number nine, why was our medical member in mechanical restraints longer than 3 hours, which is a violation of Arizona code? So at least three different times, one of our members was it. And I know James knows him and talked about him, but on the same token, being in mechanical strings over 3 hours is a violation. And yes. So anyway, these are the questions I feel like our committee needs to submit to Larry, to submit to DDD, and then find it up the chain to find out what is happening to our three members in ASH and all this information that is not being happening, and especially our one that's getting in restraints longer than 3 hours. And what I find really interesting is this a standing order, or because there are 7 in July and 12 in May, does that mean there were 7 orders for mechanical restraints, and were there 12 orders for mechanical restraints in May? And I don't think that what happened, because in other words, we also have not been getting the IRs on these individuals. This is why, I'm sorry, ASH was in the newspaper for wanting to be investigated by an independent investigator. And it seems to me DDD and Access Office of Human Rights needs to step up and do something about our individuals that are not getting their rights violated or getting their things taken care of per the Arizona Code 9-21-204. Sorry. Now you know why I don't make program review committee, because I get passionate. You're on mute, Linda.
Your points are very, very valid. I appreciate them. And just so when I was typing up and reviewing for Eva those 3 Arizona codes and reading through them, we really do need to take a closer review at them with regards to the individuals at ASH or any other locked facility that we may have in that are used by our members.
Because actually I have gotten a closed IR on a member. I can't remember what he was, but he was not in ASH, but he was in a hospital and he got put in a mechanical restraint.
Okay, James, you're the one I'm going to ask about this. So thank you for raising your hand.
I don't know that I can answer any of these questions. I actually had a question myself. Is that, does ASH have its own Office of Human Rights? Is that who, number 8, is that where the report goes to their own? Maybe that's why you guys don't get it, is that they have a separate Office of Human Rights?
No. This is the Office of, so it says report shall be filed with any patient or human rights for that facility. So that means, it sounds like it was supposed to, so wherever the member was, they have to send it to, like you said, we have some.
I think ASH is the facility, and ASH has its own Office of Human Rights. I don't think it's our IOC. I think that ASH has its own separate Office of Human Rights.
That's how I read that too. Now wait, Eva. That's how I read that too. That those reports go to the ASH's OHR. But I think that with new bills coming up, that we need to request that these same reports come to us. Because okay. The way this is written, the way I'm reading it, is that all of these reports go within ASH to their human rights, but we are not getting them. We get that quarterly report. It was you with Carl. I have too many meetings, but are we supposed to be getting the actual incident report or just the quarterly report? Because I still have not seen incident reports.
You are more than welcome to put that in writing back to Carl, because my understanding was, yes, you would be starting to see those again.
Yeah.
James may or may not have an update on that.
Yeah, there was a gap. They are coming in again now, but there was a gap in their reporting, and that was the issue. Then Carl has met with ASH, and the reports are starting to come in again, and they are being entered into IMS again. It'll say per Arizona State Hospital in the introduction to the description.
What category are they under?
It depends on what it is. It depends on what the actual description of the incident. If it was, of course, if it was, a restraint, then it would go in as a restraint or as an emergency measure.
So we can't just have them as separate.
The problem is that ASH is not one of our contracted vendors, so they go in, there's no way to pull them out separately because they are not a vendor. So you can't just bring up all of ASH's incident reports because they don't go in under ASH because ASH is not one of our contracted vendors. They go in as a no provider incident.
Okay, folks. The next thing. So
Let's make sure that we're done.
No. This is SARS. This is SARS, and this is how I'm going to get my report. Because, you see, in 962, in section number D, oversight, monitoring, tracking, and trending, number 2, the division's QMU shall track and trend the use of SARS for all members, including members at the state hospital, and prepare quarterly reports for the Quality Management Performance Improvement Committee based on the data. And that committee, number 3, shall review quarterly reports, SARS reports, and recommendations for improvements and develop recommendations to ensure members' safety and quality improvements. Number 4, the QM medical director shall review all QOC concerns involve the appropriate use of SARS on a monthly basis and identify opportunities for improvement and make recommendations to the chief operating officer. And under supplemental information, it does say in number 2 that the SARS, that Access Office of Human Rights and IOC determined that SARS has been used in violation of any applicable law or rule, the OHC or IOC may take whatever actions is appropriate in accordance with their applicable regulations and, if applicable, in 9-21-204, which means we can ask these questions of ASH and find out the information. Let me tell you, this cannot be swept under the rugs. According to the new 962, there is going to be accountability for DDD and ASH for our members in ASH for SARS. And we as IOC need to step up the plate and put it in writing and submit it. And all DDD can do is say yes or no in 21 days.
Thank you, Eva. And yes, that is correct. And I had forgotten that part about the other code, the Arizona code that you read, the second one, where it does apply to this. Let me just say this, Michelle. I can send to everybody, if you want, those three codes that Eva's referring to in email, and then they can review those. But in the meantime, is there any other comments or questions with regards to these questions that Eva has?
Well, if nothing else, we can make a comment that one of our members has been in restraints longer than 3 hours. That is a definite violation that we know about.
Eva, I'm not trying to sweep this under the rug. I'm trying to prep us for leading up to a motion that we submit these questions. That's what I'm trying to do. Get us to that point, okay?
Well, the other thing of it is they all need to read 962.
I'm going to send it to everybody.
No, not only the codes, but the whole policy.
I am. I'm going to send everything to them, just like I've sent to you, everything. Okay. I'll send it out to everybody so that they can review it. But in the meantime, based upon the things that have been stated, do we have any other questions about these questions? Okay, then would we like to make a motion that Eva's questions as submitted be submitted to Larry for questions, and I will also attach 962 and the codes to them for their easier reference. So if there's not a discussion about that, do I have a motion? Eva?
Well, I make a motion that we submit these 9 questions to
Larry
to find out that information on our three. So the biggest problem comes in is we have 3 members at ASH. So I would like the information on these 9 things on our 3 members in ASH in the May and the July report that they sent to us.
Okay, and just as an aside before we do a second, I have heard that we actually have 7 members, DDD members. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Well, we can't do that.
I'm just throwing that in there.
Let's just collect the data on the July and the May members that DD has sent us.
Okay.
And we find that out because, you know, it's going to, because somewhere along the line, QMU is going to have to deal with the other 4. You know what I mean?
Figure out. All right. Okay. So do I have a second on Eva's motion?
Please, please.
This is Carolyn. I'll second.
Thank you, Carolyn. Okay, and now let's have a vote. Eva?
Yes.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Debbie?
Yes.
Who else do I have on there? Who else is here? Lisa's gone, right?
I think so. I think Lisa's dropped off.
So I vote yes. Okay, so the majority has it. And that will pass, and I'll prepare that and get that sent to Larry this afternoon, okay? All right. Thank you, Eva, for your diligence. I appreciate it. Is there anything else regarding that? 962. All right. Oh, Lisa, did you just join? Okay. Let's talk about the incident review, incident reports. Are there any? This is number 6 on the agenda. Just general issues, any issues, concerns that we need to be aware of? Okay, number 10, updates.
Oh, I thought you were going to take care of that.
Take care of what?
The IRs.
What about them?
Well, I thought you were going to make an talk about the fact that you and I had rights issues for two different members.
We have to do that in executive session.
We're doing that in executive, Eva, because that involves specific people.
Okay.
All right. Updates, Michelle.
Okay. Leah, would you like to start us off, please?
Sure, I'm happy to. Thank you for the opportunity. Some of this is information that you've heard before, but I want to make sure that you have the most current status on things. The division continues to work toward improving the quality of behavioral health services available to DDD members. We are moving forward with the training for behavioral health providers, agencies, and personnel through the RELIAS, which is the training platform that all the behavioral health agencies use throughout the state of Arizona, to introduce computer-based trainings that have been added to the library available to agencies specifically around success in supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Starting in October, the division is going to be rolling out a weekly training session available through the RELIAS platform to behavioral health professionals specific around the Division of Developmental Disabilities here in Arizona, our collaboration with our DDD health plans, and accessing eligibility services and supports. In addition, the team is working to start to plan for conducting 2 conferences next year specific to behavioral health providers, to allow them to receive continuing education credit and to spend a couple of days learning best practices for supporting people with developmental disabilities. The positive behavior support curriculum has been drafted. It is being amended as we're getting feedback. The 7th of September is the date that we invited IOC committee chairs to join with other stakeholders to do a walkthrough of the curriculum and the training as we have it right now. There has been a review of the current curriculum by the Behavioral Health Administration here in DDD. We will have our stakeholder meeting, and we will be having an additional review before it goes to executive leadership for DDD to approve. The plan continues to be to make the training available at no cost to family members and caregivers, as well as be required for direct support professionals who provide support to the state-operated group homes and intermediate care facilities, and provide incentives to qualified vendors for having their staff take advantage of the training. There will be a weekly technical assistance drop-in that it'll be available statewide to anyone who's completed the training to provide additional support. And the division will be tracking data to demonstrate the success of having rolling out this training and the impact on our members. The division continues to work toward introducing behavioral supported group homes. Currently, they're under our qualified vendor application as enhanced behavioral group homes. With the work that is being done through legislation that is requiring a new type of licensure for behavior supported group homes, the division will be working with the Department of Health Services in order to be sure that we are effectively meeting the needs of these members who have complex needs and are duly diagnosed. The current plan is to develop 10 of these group homes statewide to support members. The division is also working at outlining a dedicated webpage that is going to track all of the different initiatives that are happening with the Access Administration, as well as with the Division of Developmental Disabilities, around improving the quality of supports for people who have behavioral health diagnoses. The division will be posting this webpage once it's approved by Access, and we will be keeping it current with the current process and where we are in implementing all the initiatives associated with this. The division is working toward receiving accreditation through the National Committee of Quality Assurance for the purposes of improving the quality of our programs and strengthen our support coordinators in supporting members. That process is going to be ongoing. You as a committee will be seeing updates to policies and brochures as we're making the impacts necessary to achieve accreditation. And we want to be able to demonstrate that we have met all the elements and standards outlined by NCQA toward this accreditation process, and that includes ongoing transparency and updating information. So you'll be seeing that through policy updates coming up through the next year. We continue to make positive gains on hiring support coordinators throughout the state. We are very, very happy with the success of our onboarding units that has been training and onboarding and mentoring new support coordinators throughout the state. We have experienced since October of last year with this new onboarding process, a retention rate at 97% of new support coordinators. So we know it's making a real positive difference, and we're excited about that. The division is posting as of September 1st, applications for existing qualified vendors to be able to contract with the division under its new request for qualified vendor application that will go into effect in March of 2024. This gives all of the existing qualified vendor community ample time to be able to read any updates and to apply for those new contracts. And Linda already gave the group the update on parents as paid providers. So those are my updates today, unless anyone has any questions. Hi, Eva.
Okay. So, just for the committee, I have attended those RIA's webinars, and they are very good. So I am very impressed that you are working with them with the training and all that other stuff. And then the second one, I just needed more clarification on the enhanced group home, because actually they were in the new policy, and supposedly the enhanced group home, you were going to have 10 enhanced group homes.
That is the plan, but they're going to be called behavioral supported group homes. Right now they are under enhanced behavioral group homes.
Yes, and I can understand why you did that, because according to the policy, people cannot be an enhanced group home longer than blah, blah, blah. I can't remember the rule. But then the enhanced group home can become a regular group home, or what did you call them?
Behavioral supported group homes.
Oh, behavioral supported.
And that language came from legislation last year about a new type of licensure that the Department of Health Services is going to be issuing for behavioral supported group homes.
Was that in the policy for group homes? I think it was group home policy 54. When they talked about the enhanced group home, they didn't mention what they were going to be called when they talked about the enhanced group home, and they could be there for a while and then it could change to, I thought it said a regular one, but I didn't know if it said it was going to change to a behavioral supported group home.
Currently, enhanced behavioral group homes are what's in the qualified vendor agreement today. With the new legislation that passed this last session, there's going to be a different type of licensure through the Department of Health Services.
So does that mean the
policy that you're referencing, Eva, I don't know the date of, and I would need to go back and do some research, because it's very possible the policy was written to the current RFQVA, which would be my expectation. And once the rules are written for the advanced behavioral group homes through the Department of Health Services, the policy will be amended to align with those rules.
Well, that, because it was just a new policy. It was just a new policy that passed, that came into effect in blah, blah, blah. So I've been reading them July.
Right, but my point being is that the legislation doesn't have rules around it yet. It
So they will have to amend the policy, and it will come out for early comment, and then
that is correct when that time comes. But it's not; we're nowhere near there yet.
Okay. Eva, they're still developing these homes. They're not, you know, we're still in the developmental phase of all of this.
Well, actually, they do have the enhanced. Well, actually, I found it very interesting that they did have a little comment in the new policy 54 on group homes, because they did talk about this enhanced group home, which I thought we were talking about that. And here they put it in the new policy. So, but again, they didn't tell what they were going to do with it.
If I could. Enhanced behavioral group homes are under the current qualified vendor agreement. However, it's a new service. And yes, we are rolling out that service. With the new legislation that passed, we're going to be amending our service to align with the legislation. And there will be amendments to the policy, because those homes will be referred to as behavioral supported group homes.
Okay.
But I don't have dates yet, because the Department of Health Services will need to be developing the rules around the licensure for the advanced behavioral group homes.
Leah, are those referred to as BERFs?
No. The BERFs are the give me a second. They are they're supported directly through the behavioral health agencies. It's a residential option, and they are behavioral health facilities that are not limited. They're more inclusive than just people with IDD. And so, those are licensed outside of, they're not through DDD. Those would be part of the behavioral health service array.
So when I'm sitting in committees and they're referring to BERFs, they're not talking about any homes that are in DDD.
They're not qualified vendor supported homes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for asking that question.
I do have a couple of questions for you. With regards to the training for the new support coordinators.
Yes.
And we discussed that at our meeting that you were in, where they're going to be coming up with curriculum specifically with regards to the PCSP. like Dee, I want to send kudos to you for your training. And I think you need to dust it off and send it over to them because it was very, very good.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And then also with regards to the PBS review on September 7th, are we going to, the chair is going to be able to review that curriculum before the meeting?
It is our plan to send you the facilitator guide with the presentation and the participant guide.
Perfect.
Please, keeping in mind, Linda, that it is purely draft.
I understand, but at least it gives an idea.
Yes, I've asked them to plan on that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sorry, I won't be there on the 7th, but there will be plenty of folks there.
Okay. All right.
I do get to take a vacation once in a while.
Okay. I get to. No, we do this on the phone, you know? All right, Michelle. Thank you, Leah. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Leah. James, do you have an update?
Actually, I really don't have any updates for District Central. We're currently fully staffed, and everything is going very well. Of course, we have some stuff to talk about at the executive session, but other than that, I really don't have any updates.
Did you enjoy your vacation?
I have not. I think I had a total of a couple of days off total. I'm actually have a planned vacation in September as well. I like Leah, after you build up so much leave, they start poking you with the stick. They start using it.
Get out of town, right?
Yes, I am in the process of moving though. So I am off a little later this week as well.
We'll take your cell phone with you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they tell me.
All right. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, James. Patricia, do you have an update?
I do not have any updates. Thank you.
I would like to just thank Patricia for all her hard work for District Central PRCs. She does a great job. She's the best. And all of you guys for signing up for the PRCs to help her. So thanks.
And thank you all for helping me. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Joan, do you have an update?
I have one update. We did interviews for the open liaison position this past week. We identified a candidate. All the paperwork has been sent up to HR. We are hoping, with fingers crossed, that the candidate accepts and that we have someone in the second liaison position. I'm being optimistic here, before the end of September, because you know how long it can take for things. But hopefully by the end of September, we will have our second liaison. So good mojo, everybody.
Thanks, Joan.
Linda, that's all the DDD staff. Do you want me to keep going?
Sure.
Okay. Larry?
Good morning, Linda.
Hi.
I do not have any updates, new updates for you from ADOA this month. Do you have any questions for me or any concerns on the prior updates that we've had?
No, I just sent you a text, though. I saw Lenny signed off. Do either you or Michelle have Lenny's contact information? Has he applied or contacted either one of you with regards to membership, or did he just log in?
He has not applied, and I do have his contact information. This is the second IOC meeting that he's attended. He's right now just kind of checking it out or testing the waters to see what it's about. But I can send you his information after. I'll speak with him and see if that's okay.
Okay. This is not the second one for District Central, is it?
No, it's not.
Well, he needs to come to Central if he's going to join. We need members.
Sorry. Yes. Yes. Okay.
All right. Go ahead. The healthcare plans.
I believe We have Dawn or Ian. Dawn has been in and out, but I think she's here
currently. Can you hear me?
There you go. Yes.
Hey, hi. Hi, Linda. I didn't know, but I was going to update on the behavior health credentialed policies that are still open that you heard about, Linda, on IOC West. Would that be okay with you if I do?
Absolutely. I was going to ask you if you would. So thank okay. you.
Yeah. You're welcome. So currently we've missed the window for the credentialed family support policy 964 that closed today. However, the policy for the credentialed peer support process and training is policy 963 that is still open. And why I think it may be of interest to all of you is it does outline all of the criteria that training agencies throughout Arizona must meet in order to credential a peer support individual. So, and it also governs, you know, what our MCOs oversee in the training process and how we provide ongoing oversight of the provision and quality of peer support. So I'm going to put the link for you, Linda, in the chat, but the page that I'm putting in the chat for you is the actual Access Tribal Consultant page that you can either register to have those updates from Access when policies come open, or you can click a secondary link that will take you to right where all the open public policies are, okay?
Michelle, when she puts it in the chat, is that something you can forward to all of us?
Yes, definitely. Okay.
All right, thank you, Dawn.
You're welcome. Michelle, would you rather I put that in an email to you so you can forward it? Would that be easier?
That would definitely be helpful, yes.
Okay, will do. Thank you, everybody.
I have a question. Tell me, because, I mean, I'm not new at this, but terminology has changed. So what is peer support? What is that exactly?
Sure. That's a covered service for individuals in the behavioral health DD, LTC, ACC lines receiving services. And what it really means is an individual that has navigated the behavioral health system, has that kind of personal lived experience, goes through a specific training for a minimum of 40 hours and learns how to assist others navigating the system and providing community resources and support, and works with clinical teams to provide that support in addition to.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
You're attending our meetings. I really do. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
You bet. Okay, Michelle. Oh, Eva has a question.
Oh, for Dawn. So it is the peer support different than the behavioral health advocate?
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Eva. I hope you're doing well. Peer supports and family supports credentialed, they often do advocate. They may attend CFTs, or they may attend ART meetings for adults in the system. The main difference between like an advocate or a credentialed peer support or family support is those credentialed roles, require lived experience. So the individual must have gone through some sort of behavioral health system recovery process. So they have to go through substance use, general mental health, determined SMI. They have to have that component of understanding what the process is, either as an individual or a family member who has a loved one in the system. The second difference would be that our advocates, although they are connected to all of the community resources, our advocates are not working necessarily within the provider agencies themselves that are offering behavioral health services. So credentialed peer supports and family supports must be working within a provider agency that offers those behavior health services. So those are some of the differences, and I could go on and on, and I know you guys don't want me to do that, but did that answer your question, Ava? Yes. Yes. Okay.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes.
Okay.
Michelle.
Okay, that is all of.
How about Frederica? Is Frederica still on? She is.
No, I am still here. I don't have any updates, but do you have any questions for me?
What's new at Access?
That's
general, right?
there's a lot that's new at Access, but what I can speak to, not much, just a lot of IOC stuff. That's my world. So I don't have anything specific, but again, if you have questions for me, I can answer.
Is there anything that we can do to help you with IOC?
Well, you guys are fabulous. So I enjoy coming to your meetings, and because you guys have a liaison, DDD liaison in Michelle, there's not a whole lot that you guys can do to make my job easier, but I appreciate it. And I appreciate your guys' professionalism, and it's a breath of fresh air to come to your meetings. So just keep being great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We try to be professional, right, ladies? We try real hard. So
you're doing a fabulous job.
Thank you. Let's see. Okay, so
I have a question for Frederica.
Oh, okay. Eva has a question for you, Frederica.
Okay.
So when you talk about IOC, are you talking about the Access Office of Human Rights?
I'm referring to IOC Access because I oversee or provide administrative support, should I say. So I'm your Michelle for the Access IOCs, which would be Central, Northern, and Southern. I do work with Office of Human Rights because they are a division here. However, my role is no longer under the Office of Human Rights. It was moved to QM almost a year ago now. So,
okay.
I think Leah had her hand raised. Leah?
Well, I didn't want to interrupt because Federico was doing a great job there of explaining, but the Office of Human Rights is who supports the members who have serious mental illness designation and they need an advocate. And is that who you refer to me when you're asking about that?
Well, you know, they a lot of these policies talk about Access OH, Office of Human Rights. And so yes. Just needed to understand, you know, when they talk about Office of Human Rights, Access, and she's talking about Access IOC, you know, the names aren't the same, and are they the same? That's why.
Yes, they're definitely not. Go ahead,
Leah.
Oh, I was going to say they're not the same. The independent oversight committees are just what you all do, and then the Office of Human Rights is there around members.
The OHR, isn't that a part of Access, a division?
It's a part of Access.
Whereas right. IOC is volunteers.
Volunteers.
Yeah.
That's okay. A great way of putting it, Linda. Thank you.
We're non-paid. All right. Thank you, both of you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Mercy Care still on?
No, I don't think we had a representative from Mercy Care present today.
Okay. Ian, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Thank you, Linda. No, I'm good. Don covered everything that we had. Okay.
All right. Thank you. All right. Moving to the roundtable for the next agenda. For next month, I just have a couple of things that I've been noting. First of all, in case you're all wondering with bated breath, the annual report is underway. That's what I have to write. And I will have it for your review, Larry, next month. So Larry, you will have it by November 1st, okay? Just saying.
Awesome. Thank you.
Let's see. And then... Oh, Cynthia McCluskey. We talked about this last month, and we had made a motion to have her come to our meeting last month, to have her come to one of our upcoming meetings. And hopefully, if she's available, I would like to, and I'll contact her, Michelle, okay, with regards to that. Come to our meeting next month to present the crisis presentation. She is like the top person I've ever talked to about crisis. And so she's got a PowerPoint. She has a lot of information, and she's also on District West IOC. She's very, very, very good. So if that fits into our schedule, and if she is also available, I know she's got a lot of family things going on right now, so we'll just have to wait and see. And then the third thing, of course, would be our update on the motion that we just presented today regarding 962. Does anybody else have anything else that they would like to put on the upcoming agenda? All right. As things come up during the month, just send me an email or a text. You guys have my numbers. Do all of you have my numbers, my cell phone number? I know Eva does. Debbie does. Carolyn does. Lisa does. Who else is there? I guess that's it, huh? Okay, everybody has it. All right, just either way, you want to contact me. With regards to membership recruitment, you guys, we are way down in our numbers. And I don't know what we can do more than what we're probably already doing, but we need more people. We're all getting gray hairs, and we need to start training younger people to take our place. So let's see what we can do about that, and anything that Dee Dee can do to help us, or Larry, anything that you can help with that. And I heard from D that you guys had some people that were interested from all of the people applied in all the districts or expressed an interest. Is that true? Or was it just hers?
There was a response from a newsletter that went out that included IOC in the newsletter, and that newsletter went out to DDD members and families.
Right.
Several members were routed to North and South,
but none to Central.
And to West, per what they had filled out on the application. Lenny has not filled out an application. He's interested in kind of checking it out. I didn't get anyone specifically for Central at this point yet.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. With regards to Tina on our committee, I have emailed her. This is 12 and, or this is number 13. I have emailed her. I've texted her. I've called her. Larry has emailed her. Michelle, have you reached out or no? I don't think so. I think no, Jeffrey did. But over the last little while, she has not responded to any of us for several months. And while she does not affect what we have to have for a majority, because minimum is four, we have to have four in our meeting for a majority, and we have six people, I think, with her, correct? So I would just like to know what your thoughts are with regards to keeping her on the committee or no. Any thoughts?
You guys, it doesn't sound to me like she's interested.
So do you have recommendations or thoughts?
I do not, but to me it sounds like she'd lost interest in being a part of the committee.
Eva, do you have any thoughts? Carolyn?
I agree. And I think maybe the best thing to do would be to like send her a formal notice and let her know that, you know, if and when she's able to participate again, she would be welcome back.
Okay. Larry, you could handle that for us? I think he walked away. Oh, there.
No,
it is.
I'm here.
Okay.
Yes. So you're wanting me to send her a letter saying that she is no longer on the committee and should be welcome back if needed or if wanted.
If she wants to be.
Wants to return.
Yeah.
And we have no idea, you know, this person may be facing like some serious crisis or, you know, we have no idea what's going on in their life. So,
I do know that she's going through a couple of things. I do know that.
Okay.
She had, but that was like 8, 9, 10 months ago, maybe even a year ago that I've talked to her last. So I know that there was quite a bit going on in her lives. It was not pleasant, but we just need to clean up our roles and we need to get, some new blood on our committee so that when we retire, they can take over and still provide the same consistency that we've been able to provide, as crazy as it is. But do I have a motion then? Do I need a motion, Larry, to do? We have to vote.
Yes, you need a, yes.
Okay. Do I have a motion? Debbie, Eva, or Carolyn?
Eva makes a motion to remove Tina Turner from our...
Yeah, Tina Bittner. Tina Bittner.
Tina Bittner. On our rolls.
Wait a minute, stop. Do we need to do this in executive? No, we vote in public. That's right. Okay, go ahead, Eva. Start again. Tina Bittner.
I make a motion that we remove Tina Bittner from our district central IOC due to a lack of attendance and communication with the chair.
Thank you.
And this is Carolyn. I second to remove Tina Bittner from the committee.
Thank you. I'll call for the vote. Eva?
Yes.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Debbie? Debbie?
Oh, sorry, I forgot to unmute. Yes, but I want to make sure that she is told that the door is always open if her life, makes it available that she would like to return to us.
Larry, all right.
If her circumstances change and she would like to rejoin us, that she's welcome.
I agree. And Larry, I'll write the letter, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, and I vote aye, so that's a majority. Thank you, everybody. We need a move to go into executive.
I move that we go into, am I on mute? No, I'm not. I move that we go into executive.
And I second.
Thank you. Okay, remember, everybody, we have to click on that link. And we come back, to this meeting to. Oh, do we have to vote on that motion? Okay, we have to vote on the motion to go into executive. Eva?
Yes.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Debbie?
Yes.
And I vote yes. All right. I would like to thank everybody so much for being on the meeting today. And the executive will be, you can hang out if you want. But we're just going to close the meeting after, I believe. But we're going to go into executive to discuss the confidential incident report reviews. So Larry and Michelle and James.
So can you tell me where we were supposed to click on again?
Thank you.
The link is in the chat. You can click on that to join it and just mute this microphone for this meeting.
Okay, we have Debbie on the phone, so she's going to need a number.
Okay.
Thank you, Linda. This is Dawn. I'm jumping off. Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Dawn. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. This is Patricia. Have a good day.
Bye, Patricia. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The number is 1-516-544-0957. The PIN is 245-720-710#.
Okay, and for those of you online, if you open up the chat box down below, you'll see under Michelle, and you just click on that, right, Michelle? And that should take us to it. Okay, be sure to mute this one, okay? Mute this meeting, and then click on the executive session link. Are you with me, Eva? Okay, all right, everybody.
We're getting good at this.
I know.
You're on mute, Linda.
I make a motion that we adjourn.
You're on mute, Linda. Can you unmute?
Sorry, I second.
Linda's still muted. For some reason, she can't come off mute. Can you hit the little mute button at the bottom? Uh-oh. Technical difficulties, Michelle.
Are you still in the other meeting?
There, I was in the other meeting. Okay.
Okay.
Everybody's here. All right. Who made the motion? Carolyn or Eva?
Eva.
Second?
Was Carolyn.
Yeah, Carolyn? I second it.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
It's a majority. There's only three of us, so can't vote anyway. All right. I want to thank you guys. I really appreciate it. It's been, I think, a very productive meeting. I think we've moved it along, and I appreciate the time that everybody puts to help us do what we're supposed to do. And just wanted you to know how much I appreciate all of you, seriously. So until we meet again, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.